So we've been mostly looking at death. We're looking at its relation to impermanence. Quite a few meditations. And this evening we're going to do a couple of more meditations on death, and then we'll do the shamatha practice. So in order to relax our bodies now and get our bodies and mind in the right space, if you have the sheet in front of you with the main points for the shamatha, if you've made notes on it, that'll be helpful. So although I'm going to go through the whole thing again this evening, this is my last evening of doing that. So now, in order to relax the body, I will just mention a few points. And just follow along from what you remember, putting into practice, remembering, you know, bringing the consciousness down, tingling in the feet, rising, scanning, relaxing on the out-breath, deeply relaxing and releasing, and raising your awareness on the in-breath. Whole body awareness, as each breath affecting the body, this type of thing, okay? See how much we remember, and I'll just mention main points, okay? So checking your posture. Begin with allowing your consciousness to sink, awareness of where your feet touch the ground and where one part of your body touches another. Noticing the flow of energy through the whole body on the in-breath. Scanning, releasing, relaxing any tension. Doing everything you can do to bring your attention inward and deeply relaxing the body on the out-breath. initiating the full breath from belly to chest and releasing. Followed by the three breaths, which allow awareness to permeate the entire body. Noting sensations of respiration wherever they arise in the body. Observing the quality of your respirations. The body still, as if asleep, and the mind highly vigilant. Any difficulties dealt by deeply relaxing and releasing on the out-breath. With the in-breath flowing in effortlessly, like a tide. To increase stability of attention, now focusing on the rise and fall of the abdomen with each respiration. Releasing any involuntary thoughts on the out-breath. Arousing your attention on the in-breath if your mind becomes dull. Cultivating vividness by elevating the focus of your attention to a more subtle object. In this case, the sensation of the breath at the nostrils or the upper lip. as you're aware of the full breath, of the sensations of the nostrils, countering any difficulties as before on the out-breath and on the in-breath. Occasionally allowing one part of your mind to gently scan your body, ensuring it's still relaxed. And so now we consider I definitely will die. Of this, there is no doubt. Yet deep within my heart somewhere, I'm perhaps not so sure. Almost as if I believe I will be last man standing. Pushing thoughts of death to a distant future, just far enough so that it doesn't seem threatening. The one thing that we're sure of, death, we tend to ignore and give it little attention. This ignorance of mortality causes us to act in an illusion of immortality. Becoming immersed in the chains of trivia devoted to the worldly concerns. We apply ourselves wholeheartedly to the eight worldly dharmas. After all, we're going to live forever. The result of this way of thinking is an ignorance of karma and the ignorance of the true nature of phenomena. This leaves us so vulnerable to continually being battered by mental afflictions. Giving rise to actions of body, speech and mind. Which in turn gives birth to karma. And when that ripens, the suffering cycle continues. There is no one else to blame. No Creator God to blame. No chaos, no randomness. We are the authors of our own suffering. And we can end it. Go over the main points again in your mind. Come to some form of positivity. Then focus. consider that my first step would be to face, accept, and live in the knowledge of impermanence and death. That's my first step. Even if I don't believe in rebirth, even then, this is crucial for my happiness. Go through that with your mind. Focus. If I become familiar with impermanence, I will begin to see and expect to experience the transitory nature of all phenomena, including myself. And ask yourself the question, can I view my death and the death of loved ones as inevitable and behave with courage, compassion, and acceptance? Can I do that? Or do I allow fear, grief, and panic to arise? I have a choice. Can I walk and act with this reality? Or be fearful, or avoid, be glib or trite in my response, and move on. My choice. Do I cling to this life as if it were permanent and unchanging? This life indeed is very precious. It's just not permanent and unchanging. If I remain aware of impermanence and death, I will be alive to the present. This is a kind of freedom. My mind will increase in its stability and contentment. And I will be able to do what is meaningful for myself and others. Review these points in your mind. Come to some form of positive conclusion and focus. Once more, we all want to have a mind that is stable and contented. We want to do what is meaningful for ourselves and others. So the answer is to be aware and remain aware of impermanence and death. This will make us far more alive to the present. And that's a freedom to be cherished. Consider. Thank you. So, just 10 minutes of pair work, because I'd like you to review what we've done on death today. It's not finished, we've got death tomorrow. Just to spoiler alert again, death tomorrow. Okay, the full death process, okay? The visions, the feelings, the weeping, the gnashing of teeth, it's all going into tomorrow. But for just now, just for 10 minutes, everything we've done, the meditations, the teachings, just in pairs, what is it? What part of it hit home? What part resonated more with you? A vibrant discussion. I'm sure all about death. Was it?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. I just heard giggling. I was going for a walk and I heard all this giggling. I thought, nobody would believe we were doing death. It's true, though. I remember one retreat we did at Leeds was all about death. I think it was the first death weekend I ever did. And people couldn't stop laughing. They were giggling. It was almost uproarious. There was over 20 of us. And people did the meditation every bit. It was like, amazing, really. I will have misery tomorrow. I will work on that. So, of what we've been doing about death, the teaching aspect, the meditations, the reflections, what part of that, if you would like to share that, actually struck home to you? Because it's true, some things resonate more than others.
We were just discussing, I was really surprised before we broke for dinner that I had some really negative thoughts coming in.
Uh-huh.
I think it was on the third, the route three, and I don't know where it came from, and I'm kind of ashamed to say what I shared, but it was...
Only share what you're comfortable with, don't worry.
No, I want to be transparent and open.
Oh, really? I've been working on that. But go ahead.
I feel maybe some of it's come from perhaps maybe other teachings that I've had, you know, over the years.
Aye.
And when I could, Venerable Mary, please excuse me, because there's so much information that I couldn't even give you the exact words of what you were saying.
No worries.
But there were, when you were talking about focusing on our karma and bringing in the Dharma now.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Good time to practice Dharma now.
Yes. And then to put in the intention and then focus on it.
Aye.
I found my mind having negative, maybe ego thoughts of somebody's trying to put something in my head I don't want there.
Okay.
Yeah. And maybe I don't really agree with this, which I was really observing, quite shocked by, because I thought, is that my ego? Or is that past programming? That was really surprising to me that came up in this, because my observation of death on my level of where I am now is none of that.
No. Maybe it's a reaction of being led in meditation. The way I would check it is when you have your, I think next week on, maybe Thursday, I'll make a definite decision on Monday. You're going to have time to do practice on your own. Maybe good to do that meditation again,
but
lead yourself.
Okay.
I tend to be very definite when I lead a meditation. And it's a surprising because I cannot bear to be led in meditation at all. I'm not good at it. I used to be good at it. I can't do it now. I'd rather be on my own. So check it, because it could be that I was being too definite, too precise, focus now, because I'm coming from the point of trying to teach this, because people let their mind go off a bit, it goes wandering, you know, and I'm really keen that they come back to what we're doing. And it could be a wee bit of a reaction against that. You never know. So do it again, but this time lead yourself. See how it feels.
Okay. I just didn't want there being anything that I was not taking up. You know, that perhaps I needed to take on and wasn't taking on.
Don't worry about that.
No.
You need to hear these things time and time again. I guarantee you'll have many, many different types of reactions. Many, many. Yeah, just don't get caught up in them.
No.
Just keep practicing. That's all. But I'll be interested. Let me know how it is when you lead yourself.
Okay.
Good, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else come up that really hit home, that was resonated with you?
We all saw Route 3. Only Dharma helps at the time of death. I was kind of going through the list thinking no money or possessions can help us. Sounds fair enough. Friends and family can't help. And I thought, oh, what about all the prayers that your family do? And in a Dharma context, kind of looking after your body, not giving you a poke.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it all depends, doesn't it? If you've got in general, family and friends. We all think, you know, we'd love to have all our dear ones with us. And really, they can be such a big distraction. But if they're Dharma, they have Dharma, then they can help you to a certain extent. In that, they won't add to your distress. They won't disturb your mind. But what can they do for you? Even your Dharma friends. Yes, do prayers help? Absolutely. Of course they do. When my mother died, my Wendy was, you know, I phoned her from the hospital and she very kindly got in contact with all the lamas and things. Why would I do that? Because I knew it would be helpful. How helpful? Not sure. I'm just not sure how helpful. My teachers tell me it's very helpful, especially people like His Holiness and Lama Zopa. I mean, these people are very powerful, you know. How they do it, never too sure. This is what I'm sure about. I die alone. Really? I remember Geshe Tashi once saying in Leeds, he was giving a teaching, I can't even remember what the teaching was about, but he stopped and he said, you know, too much reliance on other people is not going to help you. You must become self-reliant in the Dharma. And I remember, because we've been talking about guru devotion, we've been talking about this, that and the next thing. You know, we tend to get carried away with all that. And then he just stopped. He said, you have to become self-reliant. So at best, I think your family and friends will not disturb your mind. Prayers, they have their place. And I think, yes, I think they're useful. Otherwise, I wouldn't waste my time. But how useful, I have never been sure. Rinpoche, His Holiness, people like that, yes. Someone without realizations. I think everything you do is either a positive, negative, or neutral effect. That's for sure. But how much they can directly affect, I'm not sure.
I think the only way it could be beneficial is if it helps the friends and relatives be calm.
What helps friends and relatives?
By doing the mantras and the prayers.
Oh, mantras. Mantras are very powerful.
And prayers.
Yeah, the prayer. Yes. I've seen total non-believers, I've seen Jewish people read the King of Prayers with such fervour. Because I always say to them, now we're not going to be British about this. We're going to be Tibetan. It's going to be loud. It's going to be proud. It's going to be at pace. And these are people who have never seen a Tibetan prayer in their life. And after stumbling over the first couple of lines, you've never heard anything like it. Most people I meet, they want something to do at the time of death. They're desperate. And if you say, if it's not against your beliefs, would you like to say this prayer with me? Most of them are happy to do so. And then they come belting out with it. The power of that prayer, the King of Prayers in particular, is very powerful. And the mantra, very powerful. Teaching people a small mantra. There is a lady in, what's that town in that was near Ulverston?
Harrop?
Barrow, who to this day says the medicine Buddha mantra to her dog to calm her down. Because she was in a cafe one day and her dog was all over the place. My friend and I started doing medicine Buddha mantra and tapping on the end, it calmed right down. And she came and demanded that we write down the mantra, and she went out saying it. It's quite strange. People who seem to, you wouldn't think, have got a strong affinity with mantra. So these things help, of course. But personally, I wouldn't rely on it. People can be overwhelmed by grief, overwhelmed by emotion. But, I mean, it's good. Just don't, personally, I wouldn't rely on that. Unless I knew that it was good Dharma practice. You know. No nonsense. Yeah. What else came to you?
I mean, just to add to that a little bit, Mary, both Marys, I do think during the death process, somebody helping you recite prayers yourself and hearing those prayers, I can imagine would be incredibly helpful.
Yes.
There was one occasion when I was quite ill in years ago in Dharamsala, and a good friend was just saying, you know, my normal daily practice for me, which I was just couldn't, it kept bringing me back. So I can imagine if, as part of the death process, to have that help from family and friends who have the practice, as you say.
And certainly when we look at how to help people, I mean, we can't go into too much depth because unfortunately it's not, you know, we've got to do the whole of the Lam Rim, but we're certainly going to look at how to help ourselves and others at the time of death, absolutely. And this is definitely very useful. But these people are rare and very far apart. In general, really in general, unless they're Dharma practitioners, difficult. And the other thing about family at the time of death, they may have promised you one thing, but chances are they'll do something else.
Depends who gets there first.
Chances are high they'll do something else. What else struck you?
On that subject, I understand it's quite common for people to, as it were, take the opportunity to die when certain people are not around.
Yes, that's true. Mm-hmm. Yes, that is true. Mm. That is true. Yeah. In fact, yes, it is. I mean, it just is true. And sometimes you know the death process is quite far in advance, but somehow not moving on. And you say to the person, why don't you go for a cup of tea? I'll call you should anything happen. And I can't tell you how many times people passed away then. And the relative comes back, you know, she was dying, you know. Could have happened any time. But really, there's that kind of, from both sides, there's a clinging, but also a clinging from the person. It's very hard. This grasping thing. We grasp at life. This grasping is, until a certain point, you're grasping at life. And if there's somebody there that kind of highlights that, you grasp onto that. And then there comes a time when you start grasping onto death. It's very close to the end. And people actually grasp for death. They actually go. They grasp for that. Then in the bardo, they're grasping for a new life. It's amazing how much we're driven by grasping. Anything in the meditations that struck home more than others? Any meditation you preferred?
Today? Impermanence.
You preferred the impermanence one, yeah, okay.
I love that.
Okay, cool. Okay. Anything else resonating?
I think the main thing, it strikes me every time I go into a Lam Rim retreat, is, you know, why wait to practice Dharma? Yeah. It's always very, very strong. And then when you go home, you then have to put it into practice.
Yes.
But, you know, that hasn't worked.
Well.
But each time, you know,
yeah.
It was the strong wish to do so.
Yes, but Dharma practice is a smorgasbord, isn't it? We tend to think of Dharma practice sitting on the cushion, doing various things, and that's part of it, but it's not the major part. You see, because we'll have to suffer anyway. There's no choice there. We're in samsara, you're suffering. Get used to it. Right. Then what you have to do is you have to play the hand you're dealt with. The hand we're dealt with is the desire realm and a lot of suffering. And you will encounter that when you're off that cushion. When you're on the cushion, it's not too bad. As soon as you come off, all those pesky people and situations. So what you have to do is you have to turn that into your Dharma practice. You have to do it. And that's not secondary to the cushion. That is not secondary to the cushion. Unless you're a yogi up a mountain, and unless you're in long-term retreat, the proportion of time you'll sit and do formal stuff is quite small. The proportion that you're out is very large. So think, where is it? Where am I going to do the greatest benefit? Out here. This is important, of course. What meditation should do is prime your mind. It should prime it. It should make it very clear what's right, what's wrong. Get into the habit, get into the practice, make your mistakes, recognize them, correct them. Get your mind in the right state, come off your cushion, and put it all into practice. How you deal with other people, how you deal with situation, that is complete Dharma. If you turn it, you have to turn it into Dharma, because the time we have to do anything else is very short. See, samsara, you can say it's poison. You can say that, because it's total suffering. But the Tibetans say, imagine there was a poison tree in a field. And people and animals have been nibbling at the tree and getting very sick and dying. What do you do? What do you do? So some people build fences up around the tree. Yes? Keep out dangerous tree. They'll try to uproot it, but that's dangerous too if it's poisonous. But the wise person uses the poison and turns it into an antidote. And that's what we have to turn samsara into, if we have any chance. So it is good to spend time on the cushion, of course. You have to prime your mind. You've got to try and get it right. But out there, interacting with people, precious, precious human beings, so precious, you know, other people are very, very precious to you. You're not going to meet them sitting on your cushion. Sitting on your cushion, you will develop understanding of renunciation. You will develop understanding and intellectual knowledge of bodhicitta. You will develop understanding and intellectual knowledge of wisdom, of emptiness. Absolutely. But you want to turn that into reality? You have to interact with the world, really. Unless you're kind of primed, you know, from previous lives, unless you're really at the prime, you know what I mean, where it doesn't take much for you to become enlightened, it doesn't take much for you to have the realizations. We have to turn samsara into Dharma. We have to be grateful for the people around us. We have to be grateful for the people that makes us lose our patience. We have to be grateful for the negative situations we find ourselves. Because let's face it, this will continue and get worse. So might as well use it properly. So you'd be surprised how much Dharma you are employing.
Yes, my problem is sitting on the cushion.
Yeah, like all of us.
I'm happy to really make effort to try and apply it.
Of course.
Out in the day-to-day.
But the cushion's important.
Sitting on the cushions.
It's got to be done. Why? You need to calm the five senses. You have to subdue, try to switch off the five sensory minds. That will not happen out there. It has to happen here. Allowing mental consciousness to come online and develop the knowledge and the understanding. That's important. When you're out in the world, those five senses, you need to use them. So make sure you're well. This is how I feel about it. It feels as if you're priming yourself, you know. Yeah, come on, you know, I'm ready for it. You know? Top of the world, you know what I mean? So it's important, but understand why it's important. But also understand why samsara, although it's the pits, you need it. This is where you are. This is your reality. This is your reality. So make it work for you. And this is why a retreat situation is important. Not just coming in, I mean, it's important coming and doing meditations, discussing it, getting things clarified. But in that retreat day, turning everything you can into Dharma. Choosing one thing a day that you do regularly. Whether it's going to the toilet, whether it's getting dressed, whether it's drinking, whether it's eating, whether it's turning on a light. Choose one thing every day. And every time you do it, turn it into Dharma. How do I know what to do? Sit on your cushion, calm your five senses, let your mental conscience come online and think about it. How can I turn switching on a light that I do several times, you know, many times a day, how can I turn that on? How can I turn that into Dharma? Come to a conclusion. Yes? You know what you're going to do because you've calmed all this down. Go out every time you're turning on light. You make that your Dharma practice. Every time you go to the toilet. I'm not saying do it all at one time, but at least choose one thing every day that you do regularly, that you'll do when you're out of here. Turn it into Dharma. And if you want a hint, I am available. Turn anything into Dharma. We have to deal with the hand. We have to work with the hand we're dealt with. Mm-hmm. Oh dear, right, okay, meditation. Sorry, we're going on a bit. But you see, this is the beauty of, it really is the beauty of retreat. You can turn ordinary everyday things.
So,
so if you have your paper, if you've not written too many notes, if you want to write some more notes, it's probably a good time. Checking your posture. And drawing the mind inward. Allowing your consciousness to now begin to sink down. And as your consciousness sinks down, release and relax deeply on each out-breath. Being aware of where your lower body or your feet touch the earth, and where one part of your body touches another. Just allow that awareness to blossom. On the in-breath, allowing awareness to emerge and flow through the body on the in-breath. Very joyful feeling. Scanning any tension, deeply relax and release on the out-breath. become aware of the tactile sensations in your feet. And then moving up, noticing all the tactile sensations all the way up to the crown. And release and relax on the out-breath. Avoiding all movement. Taking a breath deep into the belly and then into the chest and releasing and relaxing. Taking three breaths through the nostrils, letting awareness permeate your entire body. Noting sensations relating to that respiration, releasing on the out-breath. We do that three times. And allowing respirations now to flow naturally. Just noting sensations in the body with the breath, wherever they arise. Focusing on the beginning, the middle, the end of the breath, the pauses in between. Never a time when you're not focused. Noting the quality of the respirations, long or short, deep or shallow, slow or fast, just noting. And the body now so relaxed, as if it were asleep, with a very vigilant mind. All thoughts released on the out-breath. Again and again, counteracting any difficulty, any disturbance of the mind, with deeply relaxing and releasing on the out-breath. Making no effort to breathe in, allowing the breath to flow in like a tide, naturally. So far we've been focusing on the whole body experience, and now we narrow that slightly by focusing on the movement of the abdomen with each inspiration and expiration. focused on the full movement, focusing on any pauses, always focused on the movement of the abdomen with the respiration. This will heighten your stability of attention. Using the out-breath to release any excitation. Using the in-breath to arouse a dull mind and refocus. Never interfering with the rhythm. Now, we cultivate vividness by elevating the focus of attention upwards towards a more subtle object. The sensation of the breath at the nostrils or the upper lip, wherever the breath is felt. Focusing on the beginning, the middle, the end of the breath, the pause. Always focused. Again, using the out-breath and the in-breath to counteract any difficulties. Arousing your attention on the in-breath and deeply relaxing and releasing on the out-breath. There's always a part of your mind that will notice when your mind has wandered. Just gently bring it back and refocus. Thank you. So just one or two things. Sina won't be here tomorrow. This relaxation, stability and vividness, it's not a definitive meditation. There are many different types of meditations around that may get you to the same place. What's really important is that you relax deeply, you have stability of attention, and your mind is quite vivid. What's really important is you're still, relaxed, vigilant. That's what's important. Now, there are many different don't get mixed up if you see different types of meditations that might take you there. This particular meditation is one that was taught to me and I found extremely useful. In the beginning, it can take a long time. With practice, really quite smooth. And you get to the focus of attention much more quickly. Because you can tell if you're relaxed enough, you can tell if you're stable, and you can tell if you're vivid. So it can take sometimes, people who've practiced this a long time may take only 5 minutes to get there. But your time of shamatha begins when you're focusing a single pointedly on the object. Getting there is what we've been practicing, yes? The bulk of it's been getting yourself in the right situation and then focusing on the object and choosing a time. Setting yourself a time limit's very good. We've put half an hour down there. If you want to do longer, of course you can. In the beginning, it may take you 25 minutes to get to that stage and then 5 minutes on the breath. And then you might be able to do 10 minutes on the breath, etc. You know. And remember to use the counting if you find the counting useful. Okay, remember the counting? Counting at the abdomen or here. Counting briefly at the beginning. So mentally you're thinking one. Not One. Mentally. Two. At the beginning. At the beginning. And then you'll find it distracting and you'll stop. But it may be useful at times. Thank you very much. Okay. See you tomorrow morning. Oh no, dedication. Who did not remind me? And this is another thing. When you're here doing your shamatha practice, afterwards, if you could do the dedication. Now, you can do the dedication silently if you want to leave a bit earlier or a bit later. But when you finish your practice and you're ready to leave, then do this dedication, please. It'd be helpful. So that's page 36. Give what in you do, Lama Sangi Drukyuni Dru. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. Yanchok Sencho Rinpoche Ma Ke Padam Ke Vyurche Ke Pa Nyampa Me Payam Gone Gondu Pelwa. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish, but increase more and more.